Welcome to CFRI's Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
I'm Siri Vaith. I'm the executive director of CFRI, and I welcome you to this podcast. And again, before I introduce our phenomenal panel, I do need to remind everybody that this webinar, the information shared, is not meant to be used as medical advice. And before making any changes in your care program, please consult with your healthcare team. This webinar is part of our CF Community Voices podcast series, and I do want to thank our sponsors, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Gilead, Genentech, Chiesi USA, and Mylan. A bit of housekeeping. We are streaming on Facebook Live. We have many others participating via Zoom. During the course of the webinar, please feel free to ask your questions in the Q&A box that should be located at the bottom of your screen. And if you are on Facebook Live, we are also, you can post your questions in chat and we'll try and get to as many questions as possible. So now, let's move at last onto our program. I have to say it was very funny this week. I did receive a text from a friend and it was one of those cute little baby onesies and it had Trikafta with little baby footprints printed on the front. And there's so much talk about the Trikafta baby boom. So in light of this, it's just such an incredible, timely webinar. And we're very, very fortunate to have this presentation on research and experience with CFTR modulators and contraception. So our panelists are participating from four different states. We have Dr. Emily Godfrey, who's an associate professor in the departments of family medicine and obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Washington. She's also a family physician and a patient-centered outcomes research institute, or PCORI, funded researcher. And Dr. Patricia Walker is the director of the adult CF program at Mount Sinai Beth Israel in New York, New York. Molly Pam and Laura Mensch are both women with CF who are active members of the Cystic Fibrosis Reproductive and Sexual Health Collaborative, or CFRESH for short. Molly is located in San Francisco, California, my neck of the woods, and Laura joins us from Bozeman, Montana. Welcome to all of you. We're so grateful to have you here, and I'm going to turn it over to Emily Godfrey. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Siri. I just want to say how we are just so happy to be here. We're really honored to be working with CFRI. I was thinking back of my first CF conference ever was the CFRI conference where I met Laura. And I remember meeting Dr. Raksha Jain, who's also been really supportive of this work. So CFRI was kind of the beginning, I think, of much of the work that we'll be presenting tonight. And I'm really honored to be here with Laura and with Molly and with Pat. We are speaking on behalf of the Cystic Fibrosis Reproductive and Sexual Health Collaborative, otherwise known as CFRESH. And we are a patient-driven research partnership, and we started in 2016. And we're made up of members of patients, as well as caregivers, healthcare providers, researchers from the CF community, but researchers like myself who are not necessarily from the CF community, but we're sharing our expertise as we come together. So one thing you might notice this evening is that we have agreed as a partnership that we do away with our titles. So I go by Emily, and you'll see that Pat will go by Pat, and Laura by Laura, and Molly by Molly. So. I do want to say that, I come to this work as a contraception researcher. I come to this work as a primary care provider who manages people with chronic disease, and also as a former guest researcher at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where I participated in some of the guidelines that I will be speaking about this evening and that we'll review. And, you know, the one thing I learned about being at the CDC was how important guidelines are, really, because they can help reduce barriers and help clarify any myths that are out there. And Laura will touch on that in a bit. So here are our panelists. You already introduced us, so we'll kind of move on. And Our disclosures are here on the slide. I want to put out a special thank you to the Society of Family Planning. We will be reviewing a pilot study that we just published last month in the journal called Contraception, and they funded the pilot study. But I also want to put out a special thank you to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation for continuing this work. We are hoping to enroll up to 600 women with cystic fibrosis to participate in our study in the forthcoming months. It's housed out of the University of Washington, and I'm working with my principal investigator, Dr. Moira Aiken, along with 9 other CF centers. So we're just so grateful for all of the participation and the support that we have from the CF community. And I also just want to make sure we thank the CFF for the Impact Award, and Molly will talk a little bit later about how that award is helping to fund a resource guide for the CF community. So what we'll do this evening, we'll start off with Laura, who will talk about why it's so important to talk about birth control now, and then I will provide some information about our published study as well as the U.S. medical eligibility criteria. And also what to think about when we are considering birth control use and CFTR modulator use. And then Molly will follow with a discussion about the patient-driven resource guide. And Pat is really our 25-year veteran CF provider who just sees all this in real time and will provide that real-time perspective to this panel this evening. And then, of course, a question and answer session. So, wow. Laura, I'll hand it off to you.
Thanks. This is a very timely discussion, as we have been noticing an increase in unintended pregnancy among women with CF after they've started Trikafta. This is likely due to thinning of the cervical mucus, as Trikafta affects the mucus in our bodies. Other researchers have been looking at the effects of Trikafta on our bodies, also related to sexual reproductive health. So we have an increase in unintended pregnancy. It's very important then for women with CF who are not trying actively to become pregnant right now to have a safe and effective method of contraception. The next slide I'll review very briefly different methods that are available how they work. The very first tier is the most effective methods. Fewer than one pregnancy in 100 women all taking this method for a year. On the left are the long-acting reversible contraceptives that are provided. They're hormonal methods, the implants, and IUDs. There's hormonal and non-hormonal, and they last for a long time. Each method is a little specific, but it is a really effective method for us to use, and these are hormonal methods. Permanent birth control is provided through sterilization, female sterilization, tubal ligation, or vasectomy. Those methods are used and chosen by people who do not want to ever have another pregnancy or any pregnancy in the future. They're the most effective methods. The tier two methods are primarily hormonal methods. The injectable, you know as Depo-Provera, it's an injection that's given once every 3 months of the hormone progestin. The pills, the patch, and the vaginal ring are different formulas of estrogen and progestin. That the pills also have a progestin-only pill. But the pills are taken once a day, the patches are taken or applied once a week, the vaginal ring is applied every month. Tier three methods are primarily the barrier methods that keep sperm from traveling through the cervix to fertilize an egg in the fallopian tubes. Male condoms, a diaphragm, a female condom or an internal condom are the barrier methods. Fertility awareness methods are used by women to track their cycles to learn when they're fertile and not fertile. The very least effective methods shown on this chart are withdrawal and spermicides. So I did underscore that we want to choose an effective method that's safe for us. This is an overview of the effectiveness of the methods. Yet in our community, we have a lot of myths and misconceptions about fertility, contraception, and I'm going to initiate a discussion of them. Emily will follow up with more specific information. But we do know that women with CF have been able to attain pregnancy without reproductive technology support, and now we've got an increase in women becoming pregnant. So it is true, women with CF can become pregnant. Antibiotics do not reduce the effectiveness of hormonal birth control. You do not need to make any changes in a birth control method while being on IV antibiotics. There's an exception to that. Emily will review rifampin and why that is the exception. You may take oral contraceptive pills with modulators. The one modulator that has seen reduced effectiveness in combined oral contraceptives with both progestin and estrogen is Orkambi. Emily will also talk about that. And IUDs are safe for women who have CF-related diabetes to use. I'm grateful for the researchers who are giving us more information all the time to help our providers and women with CF to be able to choose an effective method of birth control for themselves.
Great, Laura, thank you so much for giving us that perspective and some of the things that you hear from patients about birth control methods. So I'll talk a little bit about a study that we conducted. So as I mentioned, it was published in Contraception last month, and it was a retrospective survey that we provided women with cystic fibrosis, and we linked those responses to clinical information in the CF Foundation patient registry. So we surveyed 150 women ages 18 to 49 years. And what we found was that of all the respondents, 95% had reported at some point in their lifetime they used contraception, or birth control. So any one of those methods that Laura referred to, people are using. And we also found that approximately 30% of the respondents who had ever reported being pregnant, 50% of those pregnancies were unplanned. And so that is an important point to make. We're not going to necessarily talk about the risks to pregnancy among people with CF, but again, just keeping in mind that some people may have reduction in weight or a reduction in FEV1 levels compared to pre-pregnancy. So ideally, pregnancy should be planned. And when we look at the most common contraceptive methods, what we found was that the most common contraceptive method are those who are using the estrogen-containing birth control pills, or some were using the patch and some were using the ring. And the second most common, we labeled it here as barrier, but it was really the condoms was the second most common, which is a less effective method that Laura showed you on the chart. But the good news is that almost a quarter of our respondents had used IUDs at some point. And so this is actually much higher compared to the general population of women of similar age, that they were using almost a quarter were using IUDs. So there's a lot to be congratulated about in terms of contraceptive use in this community. So there are some other gaps around contraceptions. The work by Dr. Tracy Kazmierski indicates that 10% of young women with CF are receiving contraception counseling, which is not great. We can do better. And certainly almost all CF providers recognize that sexual and reproductive issues are important to address, but state that there are some significant barriers to addressing these topics in clinics, such as lack of time or with younger people, maybe family members may be present. And there was some reference to needing more provider training materials, and that's something that Molly will refer to. So for people in the audience who are not familiar with the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, United States medical eligibility criteria for contraceptive use, or what I will refer to as the USMEC, it is a document that is considered evidence-based clinical guidance for safe use of contraception by women and men with various characteristics and medical conditions. And a characteristic would be something like breastfeeding or postpartum. It's a physiological state, not a medical condition. This document is geared towards healthcare providers, but certainly it's publicly available and anyone can reference it. It has over 1,800 recommendations for more than 120 medical conditions or characteristics. And it also includes some information on drug interactions. So the USMEC has a table that has a laundry list of medical conditions that can worsen as a result of unintended pregnancy. And what the CDC recommends is that providers should emphasize the use of highly effective methods to avoid unplanned pregnancy. And I state this really emphasizing how important that this counseling is provided using a reproductive justice framework. So that as providers, we recognize our role is to simply provide informed consent about the importance of avoiding unplanned pregnancy or unintended pregnancy, and reviewing all the contraceptive methods, bearing in mind that we just want to inform our patients about methods that are safe, but certainly continue to provide patient-centered care and be respectful for any method that our patients may choose to use to protect against pregnancy. So of course, cystic fibrosis is on this list. And because cystic fibrosis is a multi-organ disease, there are other conditions that a person with CF may have that makes it even more important why contraception should be utilized if pregnancy is not planned for the near future. So the MEC provides information on whether or not it's safe to use a contraceptive method for a person with a particular medical condition, in this case CF. And so what does that mean? So the questions that really you want to answer in looking at the guideline is whether or not the person taking a particular birth control method, will that method cause potential complications or make the disease worse? And the second question that this guideline can answer are there medications that people with CF may be taking that would reduce the efficacy of the birth control method? So within the MEC, each combination of a medical condition with a contraceptive method has a recommendation for use, which is provided as a numeric classification. And you can see that here, numbers 1 through 4. And the numbers basically reflect an increasing degree of theoretical or proven risks for use of a particular method for a woman with a particular condition. So the important thing to note is that a category 1 indicates no restrictions, meaning it's safe to use, it's a green light, while category 4 represents an unacceptable health risk, it's a red light. So 2 is also a green light, not as quite as bright as a 1. But in general, the advantages of using the method generally outweigh the theoretical proven risks of using the method. Whereas a 3, think of it more as a yellow light. It shows up pink, but is really kind of a yellow light that maybe there are theoretical or proven risks of the method that may outweigh the advantages. So if you're looking for the guidance, just remember that this is your taxpayer dollars at work and it's freely available via the website on the CDC contraception webpage. And there's also an app if you have an iPhone or an Android. So you type in CDC contraception in your app store to download it. And the little icon here in the top right corner is what the icon looks like. And what you'll see when you open is there's the MEC by condition, so cystic fibrosis would be a condition, or by method, and these are the lists of methods in the middle column here. The SPR is called the selected practice recommendations. And so basically the MEC tells providers, is it safe to use a particular contraceptive method? So for example, if your patient decides they want to use an intrauterine device or IUD, but comes back to you, so you've decided that's safe, but comes back to you with complaints of bleeding with the IUD, that is where the selected practice recommendations come into play. And you can see that you can click on IUD to look for some guidance around how to handle bleeding and IUD use. We're not going to be talking about the SPR this evening. So when you type, click on condition, cystic fibrosis is in fact listed. And if you click on cystic fibrosis, you will see that every method is a green light. It's safe to use without restriction. There's one method that's listed as a 2, and that is the Depo, the 3-month injectable that Laura talked about. And basically, if you click on the reasoning, what you'll see is an image to the right in the far right column that there's a theoretical risk of osteopenia or osteoporosis because of an already higher baseline for people with CF to get osteopenia or osteoporosis because of frequent use of oral corticosteroids or low body mass. So in our pilot study that we just studied, we did look at users of the Depo method and compared to those who had not used any hormonal method. And we found that there was indeed a risk of osteoporosis that was elevated. But what you can see here is that there's a very small sample size. And so that elevation is not very precise. So in order to increase our sample size, we added women with osteopenia. And this number one, and as our confidence interval kind of passes through one, it really signifies that there may not be any significance for those who utilize the 3-month Depo in terms of developing osteopenia or osteoporosis in the future. But because of the small sample size, we are going to be studying this in our largest study that is now funded by the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. So what about diabetes? So we know that certainly from our pilot, more than 50% of the 150 women who participated had CFRD. And the majority of these women utilize insulin. So this is a good place to look if you have CF and you have CFRD. And you will see that for the most part, it's all a green light. So the non-hormonal copper IUD is a green, bright green light, but all the other hormonal methods are also a green light. There are perhaps some people who have more severe CFRD. And so you ask yourself, well, okay, should I be thinking about restricting anything? You can see the Depo was given a number 3 because of some evidence that the Depo increases insulin resistance. The estrogen-containing methods, like the birth control pill, is a mixed recommendation of 3/4. And you may be asking yourself, well, which is it? And this is where clinician judgment comes in. And so that's one thing the CDC really likes to emphasize. These are simply guidelines for healthcare providers, but they are not absolutes. And so as a clinician, if you feel that you have a patient who is at risk of cardiovascular events or thromboembolism, then maybe adding estrogen may not be in the best interest, and that would be a 4. But if your patient is otherwise stable and there's not a lot of indication of underlying cardiovascular disease, then adding an estrogen containing method would be considered a 3. So certainly we know that lung transplant is an option for people with CF. Of course, the number of people who utilize this option may decrease with the increased use of CFTR modulators, but nonetheless, I just wanted to point out that we do have some guidance for solid organ transplant. And we know that recipients of transplant are not recommended to get pregnant for 2 years after their procedure. And ideally, the contraception planning discussion takes place during the pre-transplant phase. So some of you may be asking, well, what are these, what do all the numbers mean? And what does the INIT mean? So INIT is a shortened form for initiation, and the CONT is continuation. So in an ideal world, if you have a patient who ends up with a lung transplant and ends up having rejection or some other complication, if the pre-transplant discussion happened and there was a decision to utilize an IUD and place it before the transplant procedure, then your patient would be in the continuation phase, okay? So that means that there's no need to remove the IUD as a consequence of a complicated course post-transplant. So that's where you want to look at the continuation. Where you want to look at initiation are the patients who are now post-transplant, are on immunosuppression, and whether or not to initiate an IUD placement. I do have to say, if you look at this particular guidance, and this is the systematic review that guided the recommendations, that systematic review is limited to those who had kidney transplant and liver transplant. So there were no lung transplants that were included in the review. So that's a huge open area for research, I would say, in this community. But basically what the recommendation really comes from is looking at others extrapolating from other immunosuppressed states like severe HIV disease, and that there's some evidence suggests that there may be an increase of uterine infection with the placement of an IUD when somebody is already immunosuppressed. The recommendation of a 4 for estrogen containing has to do more with the drug metabolism and immunosuppressant drugs. And there was some evidence, and again, this was more in the kidney transplant patients, that with immunosuppressant drugs, blood pressure increases. And so again, the estrogen containing methods were not recommended for those patients. So I wanted to touch on a little bit on the metabolism of estrogen containing contraception more generally, and then in the context of the CFTR modulators. Because when we're thinking about drug-to-drug interactions, it's helpful to have a good handle on how hormonal methods are metabolized in the liver. And I'm focusing on estrogen because there's a slightly different mechanism for progestins and it's less understood. But basically, you can see in the box, on the top box, green box on the right, that estrogen activates a particular enzyme called the cytochrome P450 enzyme, and this particular number, CYP3A. And it gets absorbed through the intestine into the liver, and it undergoes this first pass effect, which has a profound effect in terms of the metabolism of the steroid. So what happens is that after it kind of gets broken down in the liver and it gets reabsorbed, there's a notion of how much estrogen is left in the bloodstream, and that is called bioavailability. And it's somewhat related to a notion called the area under the curve, or AUC, and you're gonna see that in the next slide. But drugs that basically activate or induce the cytochrome P450 enzyme can often reduce the serum levels of estrogen in the blood. And they can increase the production of proteins. And what happens with progestins is progestins then with more proteins will kind of hook on to the proteins. And then the progestins also, the overall level of the progestins also go down in the blood. So one example of an enzyme inducing drug, of course, is rifampin, which is utilized for treatment of MAC. And MAC, as we know, is becoming more prevalent in the CF community. So the CDC has looked at antimicrobial therapy. And of course, we know that people with CF are frequently taking antibiotics. And again, the guidelines at the very top are based, and you can see it's all a bright green light. It's based on a systematic review that included 29 comparison studies of women taking any method of hormonal contraception in combination of oral, intravenous, and intramuscular antibiotic, and it's excluding rifampin. And the findings were reassuring for no interaction between hormonal methods and antibiotics. So one thing to keep in mind, Laura mentioned that there's a lot of myths out there about how antibiotics reduce the effectiveness of contraception. And those are very old studies that did not have comparison groups. And so it's really important that we update ourselves And we recognize that there's been a formidable systematic review performed that had adequate comparison groups and that the antibiotics themselves do not reduce the effectiveness of any of the hormonal or non-hormonal contraceptive methods. The story is a little different for rifampin. So with rifampin, we know it's an enzyme-inducing drug. So we can say, okay, it makes sense that for the estrogen-containing and the progestin-only pills, and we, again, serum levels are a little bit different for patches and rings, but for the most part, estrogen, even if it's in a patch or a ring, still has to be metabolized through the liver. So there's reason to believe that there may be some reduction in how effective those methods will be while taking rifampin. The implant is a progestin only, and I mentioned that what can happen is the proteins increase, and so because the implant kind of circulates through the whole body, there may be a slight reduction, but again, it's a green light. So if a patient's not on any other cytochrome P450 inducing drug, it's probably safe to continue the implant while taking rifampin. So this is a just kind of a depiction of the CFTR modulators. And I had to create this depiction myself because the CDC, USMEC does not list CFTR modulator drug-drug interactions with hormonal contraception. And after my literature search, I did not find any studies that have compared women taking CFTR modulators and hormonal contraception to women who are just on hormonal contraception to see if pregnancy rates differ or ovulation rates differ. So that's another area for research. So what we have to do is just apply with the science that we have, the knowledge that we have, and make assumptions. And so we talked a lot about the area under the curve, and we know that rifampin is a enzyme-inducing medication, so it makes sense that the amount of estrogen goes down by about 50%. And as Laura mentioned, lumacaftor is the CFTR modulator that also reduces the amount of estrogen in the bloodstream because it is an enzyme-inducing medication. The gray area really stands for estrogen progestin levels that are an area, or basically the amount in the bloodstream is adequate to protect against pregnancy. And so you can see that ivacaftor falls within that gray zone, as does Symdeko, as does, for the most part, Trikafta. We have very little evidence in Trikafta. All I was able to find was the prescribing information. So we can be pretty reassured that the hormonal methods while taking Trikafta, Symdeko, or Kalydeco basically are not reduced. But in terms of Orkambi, we can expect a reduction in serum levels such that hormonal contraception may be reduced. So with that, I'm gonna hand it over to Molly, and I will, I'm gonna actually stop sharing so you guys can just chat, right?
Yeah, so thank you, Emily and Laura. That was so much great information that can hopefully help guide some decisions by patients and their providers. So as Emily stated, I am also one of the board members of the CF Reproductive and Sexual Health Collaborative. And one of the things we've been doing since I joined in 2016, CFRESH has been hosting patient task force meetings monthly where we talk with patients about what topics in sexual and reproductive health they most want to know about, and to see, are there any questions or concerns that patients have brought up that should be further researched. So one of the topics we've heard a lot about since the beginning has been contraception. Patients want to know what forms of contraception are best to take with CF, which ones are most effective, and if there's any drug interactions that they should know about. So I also want to introduce and bring on Dr. Pat Walker, who's going to provide the physician perspective today in talking about how clinics talk about contraception with their patients.
Thank you, Molly. And as you mentioned, it's Pat, and I'm so happy to be part of the CFRESH group. It really was a wonderful development in women's sexual and reproductive health. Sandy Suffian and Emily really deserve a lot of credit for addressing so many wonderful topics and, you know, gathering, you know, just such a wide variety of clinicians and patients and caregivers, genetic counseling. And just like Molly, I joined very early on. I was fortunate to be part of the research advisory panel and now the governance board. And I can't say enough about how it has shaped my practice. I was blessed with as was mentioned, over 25 years of care of CF patients who informed me every step of the way. I had so many wonderful conversations with patients, hearing them tell me the things that were important to them and what they noticed. But what I think CFRESH has brought is, you know, understanding the priorities that patients have and letting us hear those things and then having it come back to our clinics and try to study these things in an organized fashion. And there are so many wonderful research projects going on right now that, you know, was the fruit of CFRESH. So I'm very grateful for that. And as Molly also said, I wanted to bring my practice further along in terms of what the patients wanted us to be doing. In our center, we always, you know, I thought took very good care of patients during their pregnancies and before. But now, as we're hearing from the research, the patients want more of their reproductive health managed at the center, not outside with the specialists. And as Emily said earlier, there are barriers to that because our comfort level with the material is not necessarily, you know, what we'd all like it to be. All the team members need to listen to the patients and start to have these conversations in the center. And so I'm really happy that CFRESH is actually, you know, helping us to get those answers that we need to be better informed in the clinic.
Yeah, so in discussing with our governance board, which is made up of patients and providers, Pat actually had the brilliant idea to create a guide. There's so much research being done by the Women's Health Research Group, Emily, Tracy Kosmirsky, many other researchers right now in the CF field, but it's going to be many years before we have consensus guidelines that come from this research. So in the meantime, the people who are the experts in all of this are the patients. So last year, the patients on the governance board got a CF Foundation Impact Grant to write a guide written by patients for providers. And the idea of this guide is to facilitate these conversations, knowing that we don't have the research, but we still need to start these discussions. And as Siri, you mentioned that there's this Trikafta baby boom, that is an opportunity to for CF providers to discuss with their patients ahead of starting a modulator, what their reproductive plans might be and what their goals really are. So both with goals of Trikafta and what it might do for their life, but also their goals of, do you want to start a family? What might that timeline look like? And what forms, like how can we prevent pregnancy until the time comes that you will want to start that family? So the guide is going to contain background information, mostly pertaining to CF. There's so many amazing resources right now about how to choose contraception in general. So we're really just keeping it very CF specific, otherwise the guide would be a book. So the topic sheets are each 3 to 5 pages, and they're gonna contain questions that providers can ask patients, questions patients can ask providers to open up that conversation in clinic, and also have psychosocial effects, specific modulator effects, and the big component is peer-to-peer advice. Again, it's women who've been living these experiences and through trial and error, they've figured out things that can help, things that'll help manage their symptoms or communities that they can join to find information. And CFRESH is one of them, but there's also CF Peer Connect, there's Facebook groups. There's so many organizations working on this. And so we wanted to create this guide so that all of that information is in one place and patients could print it out, bring it to clinic to discuss together, or hopefully clinicians will read it as well and be able to incorporate some of the questions into their practice. So some of the specific questions that patients would like their CF providers to ask them, and this can be
CF providers, it can be women's health providers, it could be a social worker, a nurse, kind of every clinic is different about, and every patient is different for who is going to be the best person to have this conversation. I think all people in a CF clinic need to be comfortable having these conversations. But they really just want them to ask, what are your reproductive life goals in the coming year or coming 5 years? And straight up ask, how are you preventing pregnancy? If we're starting you on a modulator, this is a time to really reiterate, you know, women with CF are able to get pregnant. And there's, while there aren't studies and there's no data, there is a very strong suspicion that people with CF will becoming pregnant much more easily and unexpectedly so when they start Trikafta. You'll have women who've been having, not using contraception for a decade, who have never had a pregnancy, suddenly come in pregnant. So I want Pat to address kind of from the physician perspective, we've heard all of this in our community, Siri's heard it. What are clinicians talking about?
No, as we mentioned, we are seeing an increase in pregnancies, and you know the term unexpected, as you mentioned, is really true because patients have tried for many, many years and have not been successful. And as you say, they want to have a child, and so they don't consider it unplanned in the sense of they were hoping for a pregnancy but never thought it would happen. And yes, you're right. That's one of the reasons this guide and all of this, you know, the research that's going on right now is so critical, because we really need answers. But while we're waiting for those answers, as you mentioned, we need to get the information to all the centers so that we can do a better job of getting these plans in place ahead of time. And I think that was also my goal with, you know, the thought about the guide coming from the patients, so that we can find a better way to start these conversations. Patients have been guiding us, you know, all along, but we need to have the research to back up, you know, the things that they're telling us, the insights that they have, and there are so many. I think, Siri, in one of the previous CFRI meetings, you mentioned something about, it was an insight about, you know, anxiety and things you've known all along are present and that patients and families have been dealing with, but who's going to write about it or study it, improve it, and give us the funds to help it, you know, get better. So I think this is a similar situation where we've had many insights into our patients' sexual and reproductive health concerns, but the research needs to, you know, go forward to prove what we've noticed. I know the CF Foundation is funding also more vigorous research into things like hormonal effects on CF and things like contraceptive issues in women with CF. So we're hoping it'll get to the centers quickly, but we are seeing pregnancies and we are wanting to do a better job of planning for them. You know, we talked earlier about, you want to prepare the patient to have the safest pregnancy that they can have. And I think we always strive to do that. We all share the same goal, to have a healthy pregnancy and a healthy baby. And if we can plan to make sure the things are done prior to the pregnancy, like making sure medications have been addressed. And, you know, we talk about also wanting to get maybe some studies done before a pregnancy occurs, like imaging studies and, you know, things that check your sugar, glucose tolerance. So we know planning is the right way to go. So I think the message we all have at the centers is to get planning in place and contraception if that's what the patient desires. It's exciting what's happening with Trikafta. I mean, I think, you know, as we talk about whether you can get pregnant or not, I think what is even more important and what I see is so amazing is this belief in the future, the optimism that comes with feeling better and actually believing that, you know, these medications are going to give you that future and that ability to have, you know, many years of being healthy with the children that you have. That's the joy that I see in my practice now.
Should we move down to question and answer? Okay, so I do have to share a very special slide, especially for you, Siri. If I can advance this, is it my? So there I am with Laura at the CFRI conference. So CFRI is really a force behind this work. Thank you
so much.
That
makes me very happy. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, so we have as a team been presenting at various conferences. So anyway, wanted to share it, and we're happy to entertain any questions that have come through.
I had some that were submitted prior to the starting by people who couldn't be here, but first we'll go to the comments and questions. Veronica wanted to know, how have the rates of both pregnancies and fertility changed with the appearance of Trikafta? Specifically, how much have they increased in this Trikafta baby boom?
So I can answer that. Right now, we don't know. The CF Foundation has a Mayflower study, which is looking at pregnancy in CF, especially pregnancy on modulators. So when that study gets completed, we'll have a lot more information about that.
Oh, you're on mute.
Probably good, because I was fiddling trying to find the chat box. From Anne Marie, to all panelists, are there plans to update these guidelines from the past 17 years? I think this popped up when you were showing the guidelines, Emily. Is there new research since 2003?
Yeah, so the guidelines that I reviewed were published actually in 2016. And so the CDC does update their guidelines every 5 years. So they are due to update the guidelines next year. They actually have a system where they look at all the literature that comes out on a weekly basis. And if there are new findings that they feel that the public needs to be informed, they often kind of may rush a particular guideline before the 5 year time frame is up, but the plan is to release a new guideline next year in 2021. And you're on mute again for some reason.
I should be unmuted. Can you hear me? Okay. From our dear friend Jennifer Taylor Kusar, she wanted to share, there are DDI studies done with hormonal contraceptives, and that the USPI, you can check that for each modulator. So that's probably, and I, as somebody who doesn't, DDI, what does that stand for?
It's drug-drug interaction. Okay. Yeah, I think what I was trying to point out is that the package insert, the prescribing information, often does not include a comparison group. And so what was so remarkable about the recommendations on antibiotics, and why the CDC is able to firmly state that taking antibiotics does not reduce how effective a hormonal contraceptive method is because they had comparison groups. So the ideal study consists of women who are on CFTR modulators plus taking a hormonal contraceptive and comparing it to women who are just on the hormonal contraception and looking at ovulations and seeing if there's a difference. That's really the ideal study. And the PIs often don't, the prescribing information often doesn't have that comparison group.
Then I had another question that had been sent in earlier. And again, I think everybody's so excited since Trikafta came out and seeing, you know, all these changes. So we all want information now, and we realize we probably have to be patient and let things play out. But this person was interested in, with there are the cases of people who have been trying for a long time to become pregnant with no success, who now have potentially the ability to do so. Conversely, there are many women who have happily not used contraception, happily not become pregnant. So with this, is there more, do you think there'll be an increase in tubal ligations in light of Trikafta? And tied on with that, and this is all about the communication, right, between the woman with CF and the provider, if a woman is young, it seems that there's a resistance to believe that a young woman would know that she did not want to have children and is doubted or questioned. And how do you navigate that conversation with your caregiver?
That's a good question. Also, maybe Laura can also pitch in. I know she
has. Everybody can jump in.
some experience in this realm. I mean, I could certainly speak from my clinical experience. So I have training in complex family planning, and I work at the family planning clinic here at the University of Washington in the OBGYN department. So we see people of all ages, and our philosophy is certainly, like I said, to respect and honor what our patients want. And so we do often see patients who are on the younger side, who are very sure of their decision that they do not wish to have children in the future. And I think it's important to certainly have that conversation and to honor what our patients want. There is evidence to show that, and again, this is older evidence. This is evidence back from the 1990s that women who did get sterilization prior to age 30 had increased rates of regret. And so, you know, again, as part of the patient-centered care that we provide, we offer that information to our patients. We let patients know from the chart that Laura showed you that IUDs and implants are as effective as sterilization procedures. So again, it's just informed consent. So sometimes when we have those discussions, our patients decide, you know, maybe I'm not quite ready to shut the door, which is really what you're doing when you have a sterilization procedure. I'll try an IUD. But again, our goal is always just to really respect and honor what patients desire. And some are very sure that they do not want children in the future, and they're clear that they want to shut the door at that moment. I don't know, Laura, if you have different.
Well, and another myth is that, well, we'll get a vasectomy for now and have it reversed when we want children. So the vasectomy can be reversed. It's not part of the decision making that is helpful in choosing permanent birth control. There's a lot of myths.
Have more questions. Has there been any research done or even anecdotal evidence about Trikafta impacting hormone levels or menstrual cycles?
So with the hormone levels, again, I think the scatter plot that I showed really was specific for the synthetic estrogen and progesterone levels. I would have to say, I think this is where Dr. Taylor Kelsar, this is more her area, as to whether it reduces the natural hormones we have in our body. I honestly don't have an answer to that, but it does not appear to reduce the synthetic estrogen and progestin that people take as a birth control method.
If you have time for a couple more questions, I know we're coming up in the hour, but another person asked, is the guide that you are creating only about contraception?
I can take that one. It is not. So there's going to be 12 different chapters in this first iteration of the guide. They include chapters such as infertility, pregnancy, incontinence, menopause, vaginal health, sexual function. We are hoping to get continuation grants in the future to expand it to include more topics, because there's so many different topics in this area that people don't know anything about, and that patients really want a guide so that their providers can initiate discussions with them if needed.
I think this guide is so exciting on both sides, because it is, as you said, somebody's walking in to say, this is what I wish you would ask me. I mean, so it creates this platform for both sides to have the conversation. And I think, there are CF centers all across the country, and there are some caregivers who I'm sure are very comfortable, very proactive about this, but I think some people need extra support. So this is very exciting. Let's see, I think there are if we have time, three more questions. Emily and Pat, do you recommend women with CF see a gynecologist that specializes in complex contraception and a complex pharmacist?
I would say absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the things we mentioned about the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, you know, guidance on who is part of the team at the CF Center, we keep adding members to the team because we want to become, you know, more and more expert on things like adding a pharmacist. Many centers have gotten grants to do that. Gastroenterologists have joined, and I think there's absolutely going to be a need for someone, you know, with the complex contraception training. And it lends to what I said originally, that we want to collaborate. We hope that information, you know, that comes out and the resources that we can share with other specialties, that we collaborate on these very challenging cases. And while the research is picking up and giving us the answers that we need, absolutely, I think they're a very interesting and important member to be added to the team.
Yeah, and you know, I would say that, you know, the research is always changing. It's always being updated. So, you know, that's really where someone who is fellowship trained in complex family planning can be very helpful, because they, you know, a lot of myths when it comes to contraception do tend to persist. And so often we can provide sort of the most recent literature about what the evidence says in terms of, you know, safety or use of contraceptive methods with the really array of medications that people with CF have to take. So I think it's always a good idea to touch base with somebody who has fellowship training in family planning, or, you know, a women's healthcare provider who has a strong interest in contraception and, you know, is kind of keeping up to date.
I would just add also that I think genetic counseling is another specialty that the teams just, you know, benefit. We are so blessed to have a wonderful genetic counselor, and it has helped us with this type of planning ahead and, you know, being prepared for the pregnancies that will come. And I think that's something that might grow in other centers in the future. It's a nice collaboration.
So the last two questions, they're different questions, but they're both about participation and engagement. And one is about the study that you are launching with the new funding from the CFF for the enrolling 600 women. And how do women get involved in this? Do you have to be at a study, a center that has the study, or can you cross the water, cross the road to another center to participate?
Go, Molly.
So the study that I refer to that's being funded by the CFF, and I, like I said, I'm so honored to be participating here with Moira Aiken at University of Washington and nine separate CF centers, including Dr. Raksha Jain, Dr. Jennifer Taylor Kausar. Oh my God, nine centers. So it's hard to remember all of them. Dr. Tracy Kaczmierski, Dr. West at Hopkins. So yes, we are limiting that enrollment to people who are patients at those particular CF centers. And I did not name them all. But the other thing to keep in mind is that Dr. Sandy Sifian and I were just funded a small pilot study looking at hormonal levels and whether or not, or I shouldn't say we're looking at hormonal levels, we're not. We're just literally tracking the symptoms that women with CF experience through their menstrual cycle. So we just want to see on a day-to-day experience, day-to-day basis, the CF related symptoms that may be changing or not changing throughout the menstrual cycle. And that is a study that is open to women with cystic fibrosis who live throughout the United States. They don't have to be tied to any particular CF center.
Help you promote enrollment.
Yeah, and we're hoping to start enrollment starting in September.
Great, well, we'll be talking. And then the final question, which is really to all of the panelists, is how does one become involved with CFRESH?
I'll let Molly or Laura answer that.
So we are applying for the a continuation grant right now from the CF Foundation to continue offering our patient task force meetings. But our patient task force meetings, so we're on the summer break right now, but hopefully they'll start back up in October. We'll have a monthly meeting that's open to all women with CF who are over the age of 18. So these are meetings that they're not HIPAA protected, but we have, you know, ask patients not to discuss what goes on, but they're really a support group and information sharing with providers coming. And the best way to find out about those is to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or like us on Facebook. We post flyers for all of our upcoming meetings, and they're hosted just like this on Zoom.
And there's other discussion in the Facebook group. And those of you who are watching on Facebook right now, just go over and Cystic Fibrosis Reproductive and Sexual Health Collaborative.
Well, I thank each of our panelists for bringing your experiences, your expertise, your heart and your soul to this topic, which is so incredibly important. I'm very, very grateful to all of you. I'm grateful to those who participated on Zoom and watched on Facebook Live. This has been recorded and it will be released as a podcast, and we will be promoting the link everywhere and we'll share it with all of you. Again, thank you so very much, and I wish you all well.
Thank you
so much, Siri.
Thank you, Siri.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here.